Welcome to the Negotiations Ninja podcast, where we develop and deliver the most engaging negotiation content and training in the world. We host negotiation experts, business people, and entrepreneurs, and discuss what works, what doesn't work, and how we can improve our negotiation skills. Hey, Negotiations Ninja listeners, you've got Mark here from the Negotiations Ninja podcast. Today is a pretty special day because we get to have Larry Susskind on the show. He is one of the original founders of the Program on Negotiation, which is sort of the world's leading think tank and academic research body when it comes to negotiation. It's based out of Boston, and it's a combination of a few different universities. Larry is a professor at MIT and obviously focuses on negotiations. And today we had him on to talk about his great book, which is Good for You, Great for Me. And we got into a little bit about entrepreneurial negotiation, which is another one that he wrote with a gentleman named Samuel Dinar. And we also talked about today, which I think is a super interesting topic, how do you negotiate against a 900-pound gorilla? You know, that organization that seemingly has all the leverage in the negotiation. How do you do that? How do you not basically take whatever they propose because they control or seemingly control the negotiation? We also talked about ambiguity and being able to get more comfortable with ambiguity to uncover situations where you can create and extract more value. It was a wonderful discussion. I really, really had a great time with Larry. He's a wonderful man, and really, really enjoyed it. Looking forward to your feedback on this one. Thanks so much for listening. Enjoy. Hello, Larry. How are you?
I'm just fine, thank you.
Wonderful. Thank you so much for being on the show today. I really appreciate it.
Glad to participate.
Splendid. Listen, I got to tell you, it was so nice to finally meet you in person in Boston when I was down there a few weeks ago for the advanced negotiation class. What a pleasure that was.
Well, I hope you got something out of it. It is intensive.
It was very intensive, but I really, really enjoyed it. It was just great to be in a room with so many like-minded people talking about similar topics that they love. So it was great to get that level of conversation going, which was great.
Well, it took us quite some time to figure out what a masterclass, an advanced course, should really cover, because so many negotiation courses are basically start from here. And they always wind back. It doesn't matter how many you take, they wind back to the beginning for fear somebody in the group doesn't really have enough background. And then the people with a lot of experience are along for that ride. And we really spent considerable time designing a masterclass and then working very hard to filter and direct folks who say they're interested to make sure, as you saw, the group was really all ready to fast forward to advanced.
Yeah. And you know what? I think the one thing that I really loved about it was that it was so diverse. Like, there were people from literally all over the planet at that course. It was amazing.
Yeah. Well, that is the goal. I'm very glad you found it constructive.
Yeah. Wonderful. I got to say as well, I finished reading your book, Good for You, Great for Me. And really, really, really enjoyed it and wanted to ask you a few questions based on the book. At the beginning of the book, you start talking about the key to creating value is to invent trades that are beneficial to both sides. And I think that oftentimes we as negotiators, whether we're on the procurement side or the sales side, struggle to step outside of our own quote-unquote position or our own interests even to think of what may be beneficial for the other side. What's the easiest way to do that, and how do we invent those trades so that they become mutually beneficial?
Well, my sense is having tried and failed a bunch of times to figure out the best way of helping people move in this direction is to play the game of what if. Mm. What if I give you this? Would you give me that? What if I'm not committing? What if I did this and this? Would you then do that? Those are in fact trades, but they're not. They're posed as what ifs. And my sense is, if we could agree in any negotiation to spend a little bit of time trying to what if without making commitments, people actually discover they can do that. Of course, it's hard to do that if you haven't given any thought and if you have no concern for the interests of the other side, because you won't know what to pose as a what if.
Right.
But if you say, let's take the first half hour and let's just imagine a lot of what ifs, no commitments. What if I were to offer this and this? Would you feel comfortable with that and that being added to the package? And my sense is everybody can play that game. But you have to name it as something both sides are going to commit to do for an explicit period of time with a no commitment rule. And the more people can precede that by saying, tell me what's important to you. Let me know what you really want to get out of this. What are you worried about here going into this negotiation? Let me tell you what my top priority concerns are, because there's really no point in proceeding if we're not aware of what each of us wants to get out of this. That's not asking anybody to say what their BATNA is, what their minimum acceptable outcome is. It's asking people what their interests are. And if you can spend some time doing that and then negotiate the fact you're going to negotiate for a period of minutes or hours or days, depending on the scope of the whole negotiation, playing the game of what if, people can create value.
I love that. And it sounds like when you're creating those hypotheticals and you're creating those what ifs, it's because there's no commitment, you're allowing each other the opportunity to sort of let your guard down a little bit to think about how to create value instead of trying to tightly hold on to a position.
And this was one of the most important components of getting to yes. Fisher and Urey said, look, it's a good thing to start every negotiation with a period of inventing without committing. Mm. That was their language. I think it was one of the most important ideas that they offered. For me, I can, in a more colloquial way, get everybody to figure out how to do it by just saying, let's play the game of what if for a bit.
Very cool. You go on to say those who can live with ambiguity a little longer are more likely to reap substantial benefits than are those who seek to quickly eliminate it. Ambiguity is difficult for a lot of people, and sometimes people who can't handle ambiguity to a certain degree get fairly stressed out by it. Is there a way that we can prepare to dwell in that ambiguity within the deal? And is there a way that we can mentally prepare ourselves for that level of ambiguity so that we can capture that value?
I think it's connected to the idea of what-ifing. In other words, if we start playing the game of what if, and the first thing you say is, well, I'd be willing to do this if you did that, and my eyes widen, and I put out my hand and I say, deal. And you go, whoa, wait a minute. I thought you said we were not committing. You say, no, I really like that what if. Let's close. That's perfect. Let's do that. And the protection against that, because that can't be good for you if I'm that eager, and you were just exploring to find the range of things, the range of the zone of possible agreement, you were probing. And then if I jump on that, you offered more than you needed to. And the response should be, whoa, wait a minute. That's why we talked about the ground rules here. Let's just continue what-ifing. If you like that, I may be able to do something even better. Let's keep exploring for at least another 15 minutes. And then we can talk about when we're ready to make commitments. And my comment about managing to live with ambiguity longer is, the longer the period of inventing without committing, the longer the game of what-ifing, the more likely you are to stumble on something good for both sides. And if you jump at something pretty good because you like it and you're worried that might go away, then you never discover what might be very good. And so the solution, I think, is negotiate how you're going to negotiate before you start inventing without committing, and agree to a time frame and agree to a ground rule. And then let it go and watch the reactions and keep trying to produce something even better. You know, write them down and keep the ideas there, and then say, okay, now let's move to commitments. What do you want from all the things we talked about? What should we put into a package? So the method of managing the ambiguity is set ground rules, set a time frame, commit only when it's time to commit. Another ground rule that people often say is nothing's settled till everything's settled. Mm-hmm. So you have four issues and you start talking about one, and it's not in an inventing mode. You're just trying to parcel the agenda into pieces, and you sort of do pretty well on issue one. You say, okay, can we conclude this? And the response ought to be, no, that's a tentative agreement. Nothing's agreed till everything's agreed. And the reason for that is people may want to make trades across the items on the agenda. And if you close on issue one before you ever talk about two, three, and four, you'll never know the value you can create. So ground rules, timetable, negotiate those, commit to those, and people will be better able to manage ambiguity or the uncertainty of what the final deal is.
I think the ground rule of nothing is done until everything's done, nothing's a deal until everything's a deal, is brilliant, because I think a lot of people get stuck on negotiating on an item-by-item basis and trying to close off those items. And for some people, that may be actually a tactic to close off value that other people can't access later on. And I think setting that ground rule up front allows you the unique ability to go back and do trades on stuff in the beginning that you may not necessarily have access to if you close it off without establishing that ground rule. I love that.
Well, your restatement of it is exactly right. It's exactly what I had in mind. And it's hard to get newcomers to understand this. And I especially see it since I teach at MIT, and I teach students at MIT. A lot of them are engineers. And engineers are told from the beginning of their professional lives, you got a big complicated problem, break it into pieces, take a small piece that you can manage, solve that bit, and build on that until you solve the whole problem.
Right.
And I look at them at the beginning of the semester and I say, what you think you need to do to deal with complexity in engineering is the worst thing you can do in negotiation. And they're very puzzled by that, because they think the right answer in a negotiation is to be found through a very careful kind of laying out of everybody's concerns, almost in the form of an equation.
Right.
Right. An algorithm of some sort. You know, you like these five things, I like these five things, you rank them differently, I rank them differently. Oh, we'll just lay all that out, be completely honest about everything. We'll write a kind of linear algebra problem, and we'll solve it to find out the optimum solution. And when I explain to them, nobody's going to tell you everything about everything. Why should they trust you with that information? And they say, well, because then we can optimize. I said, there is no optimize. All you can do is respond to the interests of all sides, trust a little bit at the beginning, and put out some information and see if there's reciprocity, and then more information and play the what-if game and see how far you can keep moving in a jointly satisfactory direction. But this isn't a kind of thing where you put all the pieces of the puzzle on the floor and the smartest engineer puts them all together to solve the problem. And it's a process of an ongoing process of problem solving that doesn't sound or look or feel like what you're used to. And they are very disconcerted. And when I say to them, you can go through each item on the agenda and talk about them and get some sense of where you're close and where you're far apart, but don't close because, as you said, I might care most about issue 5. And until we get to it, I'm not sure what I'm giving you on issues 1 and 2.
Right.
I want to see the whole package. And it makes them uneasy in the beginning of the course.
Yeah. And I mean, that's that ambiguity that you were talking about, right? So getting more comfortable with that is definitely going to deliver more benefits. Nassim Taleb, in his great book, The Black Swan, talks about how to uncover more black swans. And I think what you're saying, correct me if I'm wrong, I think what you're saying is if you can get more comfortable with this level of ambiguity, the likelihood or the probability of being able to uncover those black swans in negotiations is going to be significantly higher.
I think that's exactly right. And the good news is you don't actually have to have the same level of commitment to that from both sides. I hope you picked up in good for you, great for me. You don't need symmetry in the level of commitment to creating you. One side, I mean, I'm happy to do that work. The other side is nervous or doesn't know how. I'll keep playing what if. I'll put more and more and more options out in the hope that I'm going to keep moving in a direction that's acceptable to them and of course, very good for me. And I'll keep going. And if they don't reciprocate, I'll still keep going. Because in the end, it's better for me.
Hey, listeners, we're going to get back to your show in a moment. But first, we're going to have a word from this show's sponsor. Are you looking to build a strategic sourcing or procurement organization this year? Do you have expertise or knowledge gaps in your existing team that result in missed savings goals? Do you need help figuring out if your vendor pool is calculating your taxes correctly? If you answered yes to any of these questions, there is help. SpendLogic Group leverages decades of real-world procurement experience to drive your success. You may remember Mike Cadieux from episode 45. He's the guy that took the bold move to go from chief procurement officer to entrepreneur. Well, this is his team. Mike's team has decades of experience managing billions of dollars in indirect spend across all indirect categories. And now they want to help you. You can contact them at info@spendlogicgroup.com or call them at 800-484-0536. I have no doubt that it will be well worth your time to chat to Mike and his team. And now back to your show. In your book, you talk about the level of differences between both parties negotiating with each other in terms of power. And you say when you're negotiating with a 900-pound gorilla, someone who seemingly has all the leverage in the negotiation, you talk about creating an elegant solution. What do you mean by this?
So this question first came up in my practice when I was asked to help small companies that occupy a space in which there's one near monopoly, near gigantic gorilla. And they said, what can we do? How can we handle this? And I said, well, the first thing you could do is try to figure out something that the really giant gorilla wants and that you can provide at a reasonable cost to them, and then trade it for the things that you want. And so I remember the company's out of business now, but there was a company that used to provide kiosks at some of the really large wholesale stores to, in which you could bring your photographs and come back an hour later and get your photographs all made. And this company was trying to negotiate with one of the largest retailers or wholesalers in the country. And the wholesaler kept saying, I'm giving you smaller and smaller amounts of space for your kiosk, and I'm taking larger and larger percentages of your gross. And if you don't like it, go somewhere else. Of course, there isn't somewhere else. And so they said, how do you negotiate with this? They have other people they can go to. They could do the whole thing themselves. Don't you just have to say yes when they say this? And I said, can you bring in a new stream of people to buy stuff in their store who would never otherwise come to their store, but who, because of the small thing that you're providing, the service or the product, you bring them new customers? And what about an experiment to show them that if they let you have a little more space and help you with the advertising, that in fact, that will bring in more people who would not otherwise come to their store. No matter how big they are, there's some benefit you can create if you use what you have, which is unique, to benefit them and you. And they said, well, why should they go along with it? You know, they can probably take my idea and get somebody else to do it, and they could still keep more of the take. And I said, well, work on building the relationship. Talk to the store manager, not just to the salesperson for the whole company. You know, you really working closely with the particular location manager, they know that in fact you have a capacity to bring in people that wouldn't work with them. Or maybe you could carry a line of additional products that they don't carry and they don't want to carry, or the local would love to carry, but their central headquarters won't work it with them. And they do the same with all their stores around the country. And you say, I'll carry these products. And you can advertise them. And when people come to my little kiosk, they can get those items. And that's a benefit to you because they're in the store. And if necessary, you know, I can start by giving you a percentage of the take on these new items, especially if you would help put them into your marketing material at your cost. And what you're doing is you're taking something unique, even if you're tiny and they're gigantic. And the elegance of the solution is that it's good for them. It may be great for you, but it's good for them. Why would they turn down something that's good for them? So instead of thinking I'm powerless, they're gigantic, they're going to throw me out, there's nothing I can do, oh, please, oh, please, oh, please, you know, let me stay here, don't charge me too much. Start to create value. Start to explore possibilities. Do things experimentally. Deal with the local representative where you have a relationship you can build on. So that's what I mean by an elegant solution. One that meets interests that you didn't know they have, or they don't have another way to meet, no matter how big they are. It creates a benefit for them and creates a really good benefit for you.
Very cool. There is one thing there that I want to dive into a little bit, where you speak about creating relationships. Now, I think what a lot of people default to is they think because they're dealing with one person within the 900-pound gorilla organization, that that's the only person that they can deal with. And therefore, they're limited to that. And one thing that I love about your work in multi-party negotiations is whenever you're selling to or negotiating with another party, it's not just one other person within that party that you may be able to develop a relationship with. There may be multiple stakeholders that are within that other organization that you can create alliances with and develop relationships with to help leverage your influence within that organization.
Absolutely. And it's not just that you need them to be an ally to go at the other party on their side. They may actually have specialized knowledge that can be beneficial to you.
Right.
So, right? If you're dealing with the procurement person over and over again in some organization, not not necessarily the 900-pound gorilla story, but suddenly this procurement's been added, right? You have a long relationship with this company, you sell them a service, and you show up to renew the contract, and you don't get to talk to the person you've been providing the service to, who's very satisfied with the service, because the company has introduced procurement. And the only way procurement's getting paid is if they reduced the cost to them of the contract with you. Mm-hmm. So if you just deal face-to-face with that procurement person, you're going to have a hard time increasing the value of the contract to you. But if you, in some way, reach out to the person that you worked with directly and say, you know, procurement's asking me for this and this. They want a 10% reduction in the contract that we have with you guys. We can do that, but we can't provide you with the team that you've gotten used to working with. We'll have to use people who we charge a lower rate for, because he's just saying, provide the same service and cut the benefit. And then let that person go talk to procurement and say, look, I can't have a different team. They're the best ad people that we have, the best advertising company we can find. We work really hard to build a connection to them. And I know you have to reduce the contract, but you have to find a way to do that which doesn't push out the people on their side that we're used to working with. So you've built an ally, but you also have somebody who in fact needs and can speak to the value of what you have been providing. Mm. So it's not just a strategic ally to bring leverage on the other side. They actually know a lot about what you do, and they can, with that knowledge, speak to procurement or even to the back table that they both, procurement and the other part of the team, report to and say, we can't do this. I understand why we have to reduce it. And maybe we can reduce the scope of the contract, but we can't just tell them to do the same thing for a lower price, or I'm going to lose the people. And you can look inside of our organization. Look at the back table that the people that you're talking to report to. Now, you can't always contact them directly, but one strategy you can do is put forward multiple very different proposals. And clearly, there's going to be a burden on the person you're talking to take that kind of a choice back to the back table. So in a sense, you can communicate with your negotiating partner's back table by putting forward radically different, but equally okay with you, versions of a proposal or a contract. And suddenly, you might be able to lasso in some member of their back table to advocate your point of view.
Yeah, that's a really good idea. Sometimes when we get caught up in these types of negotiations, we're stuck in a situation where we believe the other party is being either irrational or illogical. And I think sometimes we default to thinking, well, obviously we're going to have a logical discussion. We're going to have a rational discussion in this negotiation. And quite often that doesn't happen because someone is emotionally attached to some sort of outcome, or they're emotionally attached to something that they're holding on to. When we get into that type of a situation where there's that roadblock, how do we overcome that situation where people are being irrational or illogical?
Well, the first thing is you think they're being irrational or illogical. That looks to you like they are. Right. In many instances, they don't think they're being irrational or illogical. And so the first thing is not to assume that they're out of control, that it may be that you just don't understand the importance of the logic of what's happening on their side, in which case you definitely want to have somebody else come with you and interact with these other folks who doesn't start with your biases. There are people you bring in, or you bring a partner for the next round of negotiation, and all you ask them to do is listen. And maybe during a break, you let them have a private moment with the people you've been talking to. And first, get some independent check on whether it's just you who doesn't get it. And to me, that's very important, because I have had people tell me this person's impossible when I'm mediating. They're saying, you were there. They're impossible. They don't listen to anything. They lost it. What should we do? And I said, I'm not so sure that that's the only way to see it. And they're startled to have another take on what they saw. So that's step one. Bring someone else with you that you trust and ask them to verify or validate your estimate of how irrational or illogical the other side is. Now, if they come back and they say to you, boy, are you right? You're stuck with someone who doesn't take any kind of argumentation seriously. They don't listen, or they don't seem to get it, or they just don't believe anything that's not consistent with their interests. And at that point, you want to look for an ally on their side in some of the ways that I've described already, and say maybe that you need to find a way for them to have to double check with someone on whether what they're saying is plausible, reasonable, appropriate. And if you can't do that or that doesn't work, my argument would then be ask them to propose an alternative agreement that meets their interests and yours. Say, obviously, what I've been proposing you find completely unacceptable. I've given you my reasons why I think it responds appropriately to your interests and mine, but you keep rejecting it no matter what I do to sweeten this. So what is it you propose? You give me a detailed proposal that you like and that you think I can accept, and we'll start from there.
Yeah.
And put the burden back on them.
Put the onus on them to come up with a solution if you think they're being irrational. That's a really good idea. Larry, if you could leave the listeners today with one thing, and this is a difficult question, I know, because how do you narrow it down to one thing? But if you could leave the listeners today with one thing that you would want people to work on with negotiations, what would it be?
I think to spend more time in preparation for any and every negotiation. Whatever time they're spending, if it's 1 minute in advance of walking into a room, spend more than a minute. If it's 1 hour in advance of going to negotiate a contract with big consequences, spend more than that. If it's 1 day out of a year-long enterprise that you know you're going to be negotiating out in great detail, you're probably spending too little time in preparation. Secondly, you're probably not focusing enough on how the problem looks from the other side during your preparation. Split your preparation in half, however little it is. Look at the problem from your side. What are your interests? What proposals can you make that meet your interests? What are the arguments you're going to make on behalf of your proposals? What are the criteria you're going to use to make a case for what you believe? And then do the same thing as best you can by putting yourself in the other side's shoes. I am absolutely convinced empirically that if people increase the time they put into preparation, they're happier with the results. And often people just say, well, I don't have the time. I can't do it. But my feeling is if you set aside the time, you say this is absolutely crucial to my success. And the third point about preparation is, often negotiation is an organizational task, and people are thinking of it as an individual task. And so they do prepare, but they prepare from their point of view, they prepare for their side, and then they go into the negotiation, and then they bring back to their organization what they think the proposed agreement or even the suggested final agreement is. That's too late to be involving your own people.
Right.
And my feeling is this is all part of people's theory of practice with regard to preparation. And I think people need to commit to more time thinking about the problem from the other side's perspective, and more time checking back with and exploiting the knowledge that's inherent in the abilities of their own side.
Yeah, I think people, they get themselves into a situation where they think they don't have time. But I think the more time that you can put into preparing on the front end, you're going to make it up on the back end in terms of the fluidity of the negotiation and what you're able to uncover in terms of value.
I can attest to the fact that when I'm, especially when I'm in the middle, when I'm mediating, the people that come prepared shape the agenda. The people that prepared do the most value creation. The people who come prepared can defend themselves against efforts to claim value by the other side, all because they're relaxed, they're knowledgeable, they're clear about their authority, and it shows. It just shows, always. I can trace it to how much preparation people do. And this is not a function of experience. Indeed, the more experienced people know that they have to put in more time, not less. Their experience doesn't substitute for the homework you need to do each time.
Brilliant. Love it. Larry, if people wanted to follow you online and follow your work, I know you just finished a great book with Muli Dinar on entrepreneurial negotiation. If they wanted to find out more about that and some of the work that you're working on now, how do they do that?
Entrepreneurialnegotiation.com is all about the book and all of the videos of our interviews with entrepreneurs in the Boston area, which is part of what we used to build the presentation in the book, entrepreneurialnegotiation.com. A lot of my public disputes work is described in another website called scienceimpact.mit.edu. All the work I do on public dispute resolution is linked to that site, scienceimpact, as if that were one word, .mit.edu. And I do have a personal website that's just a kind of updating of my teaching and training and scholarship, and that's laurensuskind.mit.edu.
Wonderful. And for the listeners, just so that you know, I will be linking out to all of these websites in the show notes for the show, so you can just visit negotiations.ninja and take a peek at the show notes for this episode with Larry Susskind. Larry, thank you so much for being on the show. It's been a true pleasure, and looking forward to hopefully doing it again soon. I know we're going to have Muli on the show early next year, which I'm very excited for too. But again, thank you so much for being here today.
You're very welcome. Lovely to talk with you. Keep up the good work.
Hey friends, thanks so much for listening to this episode. If you enjoyed it, please share it with friends and colleagues so that they can benefit from it as well. If you find Negotiations Ninja Podcast worthy, please go on to iTunes and give us a cool rating with a nice review. We certainly appreciate every single one that we get because it helps us to understand who is listening, how they're listening, and what it is they like. If there's something that you would like me to discuss around negotiation, influence, or persuasion, give me a shout. You know how to reach me on social media, or you can get me on my website, which is www.negotiations.ninja.